Thank you, Dave. So, many of us will know Helen. How many have been to hear Helen before? Many, but not all. There you go. You didn't put them all off last time, like you said, like you feared. So Helen and I have known each other for a number of years now, and it's been great to visit and talk and wrestle with ideas. I mean, I do the wrestling, she does the imparting of wisdom and knowledge. But it's been great, and particularly over the last couple of years, Helen, your trajectory has been very much around this issue, hasn't it, texts in the Old Testament that are difficult because they appear to attribute violence and other malicious acts to God. And as we've just sung, our bearings as Christians come from Jesus Christ, and there seems to be a conflict between the God we see in Jesus Christ and the God that we sometimes appear to see in those texts in the Old Testament. And we often don't know what to do with them. That's highlighted when in our churches sometimes we read Psalms and we're tempted to dip over a few verses that talks about God doing unpleasant things to babies' heads and so on. And we love the rest of the psalm, but that's a bit awkward. We don't quite know what to do with those texts. And so I'm really grateful that Helen's given her life, really, the last few years, to wrestling with this stuff as a Hebrew scholar and as an Old Testament expert. And grateful for you coming tonight to give us some insight into this issue. So do come, Helen, and take us on.
Thank you. Well, it's lovely to be with you. And I had very little expectation that there would be more than a couple of people here, if at all, tonight. So partly because of the topic and partly because of what's going on nationally and internationally. But thank you for coming. Let me just say at the outset, and I'll perhaps mention again, I'm not going to be able to answer all your questions. Actually, even if I had until the rest of my life, I wouldn't be able to answer all your questions because I don't have all my own questions answered. But even what I would be able to say, obviously, I can't do in an hour. So I'm going to just try and, you know, give you a few tasters and a few pointers. If you want to continue to engage with these questions, then as David mentioned, I do a lot of work in this area. I'm not alone. I'm now director of something called the Centre for the Study of Bible and Violence at Bristol Baptist College, which is gathering scholarship and having collaborative conversations with others who are working in the same area. And so we're gradually building up a set of resources for the church. So if you have a look on our website, there's a blog there, there's various all sorts of things, podcasts and things, and we're gradually adding to that as well. So you may find something there that would be helpful if you continue to have questions that you want to think about. What I want to do is, first of all, talk about some basic foundations for how we read the Bible in order to help us to think harder about these particularly difficult texts. That's a picture, it's just for entertainment really, or just for interest. That's a picture of the Leningrad Codex, which is the best ancient text of the Hebrew Bible that we have. And as you can see, well, I mean, unless you read Hebrew, you won't be able to read it, but I hope you can see, actually, it's remarkably clear. It's really very, very good quality piece of text. And that's the sort of thing that our textual scholars grapple with. Fortunately, I have it in a book that I can read, or at least sometimes read. Let me talk a little bit about my own presuppositions as I come to the sort of texts that we're talking about. It's really important that we acknowledge our presuppositions because we always start reading scripture, or in fact, any text at all. We always start reading from somewhere. We bring to it our expectations, our life experience, our prejudices, and everything else that we are, really. And to some extent, what we conclude from that will be conditioned by what we bring to it. So it's important to state that. And I'm reasonably confident that most of us would share these presuppositions. So my first one, my prime one, which David's already referred to, is that the fullest revelation of the character of God is found in Jesus Christ, in his birth, his life, his death, and his resurrection. And that is the lens that I want to apply to everything else that I read in Scripture. My second one is that the Bible is God's word to us. Now, we could spend, and in fact, I have stood here and discussed that very question with you in the past, and there's a complex set of issues behind that simple statement that I haven't got time to discuss tonight. But nonetheless, This is my own conviction, that the Bible is God's word to us. And when I find things in it that I don't enjoy or like or understand, then my responsibility, and that takes me on to the third point, is that I need to wrestle with it. I need to grapple. I need to ask, Lord, how is this your word to me? What is this? How do I read this? How do I understand this? How do I see your good character in this? And I, as I say, I don't always bottom those questions out, but these are the questions that I'm asking continually, and this is where I start from. A few very broad points to help us to avoid misinterpreting the Old Testament. Do you remember this advert? Some of you may remember this advert. It's from a few years ago now, but it does illustrate my point quite nicely. It was for a global bank. I think it was HSBC. And this hapless businessman is traveling in the Far East. I think it's an unspecified country in the Far East. And his generous hosts give him, top picture, an eel, which is not really his normal cuisine, but he's English, and we know that the polite thing to do is to clear our plates, don't we, when we're out. And so he gulps and eats it and clears his plate. And his hosts are appalled that he has cleared his plate. And so they bring him a bigger eel, which he then feels obliged to eat. And I think this process goes through about three or four times until finally they're kind of staggering out with this conger eel because they are determined that they are going to feed him until he is satisfied, and he is determined that he is going to clear his plate. This is the clash of worldviews that the advert was trying to highlight to us, but it illustrates to us quite well, I think. If we sometimes talk about the past being a foreign country, well, when we think about the Hebrew Bible, the world of the Hebrew Bible, and that's the, I generally refer to the Hebrew Bible rather than the Old Testament, but I may use the terms interchangeably. When we think about the world of the Hebrew Bible, it isn't another country, it's another planet. They think so very differently to the way we do. We are all, consciously or not, mostly not, we are all children of the Enlightenment. We all are shaped by the great thinkers like Descartes and so on. And we have been taught by people who were shaped by those. And so the questions we bring, the approaches we bring, the things that puzzle us are Enlightenment questions. And very often they are not the things that our ancient writers would have ever thought to address or would ever have puzzled them. I think I've got a couple of examples here. So, to understand the different worldview, a couple of, and again, I can only sketch these out very briefly, but to kind of give a clue. They are much less interested in cause and effect, and I'll say a bit more about cause and effect in a minute, actually, but they're much less interested in cause and effect and explanations for things than they are in what we call analogical thinking. Now, I'll give you an example, which you won't understand, but that's kind of the point. I don't understand it either. And the example is this. Why is it that it is forbidden in Leviticus to eat swarming insects? And the answer is because menstrual blood is unclean. Okay, now I don't think anybody here will understand that connection. And yet, to the ancient mind, that is intimately connected and makes sense. So if that gives you a kind of glimpse into the fact that they think very differently, let's not imagine they think they're more primitive than we are or more rudimentary than we are. They have great nuance and skill and art and complex thought, but it's different from ours, and we must understand that. And some of the issues that we have as we face the text are because we are asking Enlightenment questions of a very, very pre-Enlightenment text. Another example of the way that they think differently is in the question of what is a good society. Now, if I asked you what makes for a good society, you probably would talk about things like human rights. You'd probably talk about education for all, about opportunities for everybody to achieve their full potential. That's the sort of language we might use. It's a whole other whole shedload of things we talk about, but those are some examples. These are not the things that they would understand to form a good society. Individual human rights would have been really quite puzzling to them, I think. They're much more interested in community relations, in family relations, in society as a whole, and society as a whole stood or fell together. We could learn a thing or two, actually, quite frankly, from that, I think. But their idea then of what a good society is and what makes for all is very different. And one of the things they're particularly interested in is order. We're much less interested in order than we are in self-actualization. And order is a kind of, I think for most of us, a kind of a means to an end. But for them, order was one of the primary things. And in fact, so much so that the way that they thought about creation was the clearing of chaos to create order. And that made, that defined a good society. And the third thing, and there's so much we could say here, but the third thing that it's worth flagging up is that they have a great deal of subtlety with regard to who causes things that we read, bad things especially. If I give you a modern example, perhaps, to try and illustrate that. If you were to look up a parliamentary select committee that was held a few years ago into the causes of knife crime, then you could read evidence given by a number of different experts. There is evidence given by a neurophysiologist or something, neuropsychiatrist perhaps, who talks about underdevelopment of a certain part of the brain in the people who are involved, many of the people who are involved in knife crime. There is evidence from people who are looking at parenting and perhaps sometimes absent fathers. There is evidence from others who are looking at the easy availability of weapons, and so on. There's a whole load of experts who come and give their explanation as they see it for why the knife crime epidemic is happening. Now, I don't think that that we would struggle to hold those things together and to say, actually, I think clearly there looks as if there is some sort of perhaps some sort of neurological underdevelopment in some of these individuals, and actually absent fathers probably makes a difference as well, and easy availability, and we can hold those things and we say all of these things are relevant. And yet somehow we sometimes fail to bring that subtlety to our reading of the Hebrew Bible. I'll give you the prime example is in the book of Samuel. We read that God incited David to hold a census, which was forbidden, incidentally. And because David held a census, there was some disaster came upon the land. Now, in the book of Chronicles, we read the same story in almost identical words, except that it says, Satan incited David to hold a census. Now, I've heard it said, and this is absolutely incorrect, but I've heard it said, oh, well, that proves that the God of the Old Testament is Satan, and of course it doesn't, anything of the sort. But you can understand why somebody might kind of immediately jump to that conclusion. I think the thing is that the ancient writers are able to hold with subtlety the idea that bad stuff happens, and Satan may well be behind that, and sometimes it's the bad stuff that happens is to do with evil people, but that actually everything takes place under the purview of God, and nothing takes place without his permission. And so they are able to interchange these two languages, the idea when Babylon comes and conquers the land, and who did it? Did it Babylon do it, or did God do it? Well, yes, says the ancient writer, with no difficulty at all, because they have that sort of subtlety. So that's one of the things that is worth flagging up, I think, in order to help us to understand some of these harder texts. Next tip I would have for avoiding misunderstanding the Hebrew Bible is that we should be really greedy with it. We should read really big. I think it's probably because we are used to, traditionally, even if we don't do it these days, I hope we still do, really, but we are used to digging deep into Scripture, and sometimes that involves drilling down very small, particularly in things like the letters of Paul, and in the Gospels, which, you can take a very small part and really, really dig away, and there's so much value to be gained from really deep drilling. With the Hebrew Bible, it's much harder to get that from a very small section. You just need to see it in the big picture. Even stories, very familiar stories like David and Goliath, probably not one that causes you difficulties, but one that you'll know very well, I imagine. Even that story, we will understand much, much better and much more deeply and richly if we fit it into the big picture, which begins, they always begin in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. All of these pictures begin there. So much theology in those chapters, and I'm not remotely interested in the scientific question that people sometimes talk about, but the theology of those chapters is deep and rich and sets a whole load of balls rolling, which we need to spot when we're reading David and Goliath, or you know, the slaying of the Amalekites, or whatever it is. We need to understand how that connects back. So learning to read big, learning to look for the deep themes is a really essential way of reading the Hebrew Bible well. And for that, as really for many of the things I'm going to be talking about, we need a companion, really. We need people who, unless, you know, this is why theological colleges exist, because we don't all have time to sit and, you know, and inclination to sit and do this very, very hard, detailed, thorough, and very time-consuming work. But we can learn from those who do. And so finding companions on the journey, as it were, finding those who have done this sort of study and can guide us is very useful. And then my next tip is that we need to understand the genre of what we are reading, and we will enormously misunderstand if we fail to notice the genre of what we're reading. I've got a funny feeling I've used this illustration here before, but I'm going to crave your forgiveness if I have. Imagine you're walking along the road, and you pick up a piece of paper, and it says that, which I hope you can read. What have you picked up? What sort of thing have you picked up, do you think? You don't need to read it all. What sort of writing is it? Yeah, it's probably a newspaper cutting, isn't it? Okay. What about that one? Particularly dreadful piece of romantic writing, yes? This one? Okay. And that one? Okay. So we instantly recognize those things, and we are vanishingly unlikely to confuse a recipe for a fairy tale. Yeah. Or a fairy tale for a piece of journalism. But let's imagine those pieces of paper get lost to us and get buried and are uncovered 3,000 years from now, okay, in a completely different culture. Now, the first thing they're going to have to do is they're going to have to translate them. But that is the least of their worries. Because once they have translated them into the language that they can understand and whatever they're speaking in those days, they then need to try and decode them according to our culture. And if they... The danger is that they will not know that, for example, this is a fairy story, and they might think we actually believe in talking bears. Yeah? Mightn't they? Or, if I go back for a minute, they might think, is this the one that talks about palpitations? Oh, there's a version of this that talks about palpitations and Cupid's arrow, and they might think that this is a medical description of something, you know? I mean, understanding the genre is absolutely critical. And we do it with modern writing, we do it instantly and easily. But with ancient writing, you can see, I think, that it's a lot more challenging. And we need to be aware of the genre of what we're reading so we don't misunderstand it. In particular, with regard to the questions of the violence of the Hebrew Bible, there are two particular genre questions that I think are very important. And one is to read history as it is intended to be written. The ancient writers of history were not interested in giving a kind of impartial journalistic account of events. Now, don't hear me say that they weren't interested in truth, because they most certainly were interested in truth, but they are not interested in giving an impartial journalistic account of events. And actually, we all know that there is no such thing as an impartial journalistic account of events in any case. It doesn't exist. But they make no pretense to it. We see a clue for this, actually, in the New Testament. If you read the Gospels, two of the Gospel writers tell us really clearly why they have written the Gospels. And they make no pretense to partiality. You know, this is written that you may believe. Yes? The Hebrew Bible, the writers of the Hebrew Bible are doing something similar. They are writing for a purpose. They are writing to persuade. Now, that is not saying that what they are writing is not true. Please don't misunderstand me. But their prime concern is not to give you a factually precise, blow-by-blow account of events. Every time we write a history, or we tell a story, because as soon as you tell a story about what happened earlier today or last week, you're actually constructing a history. Every time we do that, we make a selection. We choose what we tell. We choose where we begin, where we end. We choose what we include and what we exclude. They're no different. So we need to understand that. And to try and interrogate those ancient histories for historical facts is not always, well, it's not what they're intended for, by and large, and it's not always the most fruitful way of reading them. What we need to be reading them for is to say, what is the theological point? What is this wanting to say to me about God? And that's where that's a much more fruitful question. And then alongside that, and this is something I'm particularly interested in, and I could also talk about for a very long time, but I won't, is to learn to read narrative as it is intended. The writers of the Hebrew Bible, of the stories of the Hebrew Bible, were by and large very, very skillful storytellers. And they employ all sorts of storytelling techniques that good storytellers employ. And they use some of the same ones that we will be familiar with and some that we won't be familiar with. But we need to learn to look for things like plot, characterization. Here's a top tip. When people speak within a story, they may not be telling the truth. And we often tend to assume it's written in my Bible, therefore it must be true. The narrator expects to be believed. Okay, whether you do or not is up to you, but the narrator expects to be believed. But the characters that the narrator tells you about, you do not have to believe them. You need to evaluate that for yourself. Look at the story of Samson, for example. And Samson makes some particular claims. It's clearer when you read it in the original language. But he makes particular claims that he is being just absolutely fair and scrupulously obeying the eye for an eye commandment. There is, before I go on to what I was going to say, and many commentators have been duped by him. Many commentators have been duped by him. Open a random commentary on the book of Judges, and it will tell you, and Samson was just being scrupulously close to the eye for an eye. No, he was not. So the thing about an eye for an eye is it's exactly measured. You know, an eye for an eye, not an eye for a life for an eye or whatever. So it's exactly comparable. It's exercised upon the person who commits the wrong, not upon some random stranger. And it is done in a kind of quasi-judicial setting with the elders of the village involved. It's not just done with some random person going off at a sort of blood fest. Samson breaks all of those rules. He says, I'm doing an eye for an eye, but he doesn't on any occasion do that. And yet, failure to realize that people lie within narrative makes us misunderstand that. Does that make sense? So the narrator expects to be believed, but the narrator may well tell you what people said, expecting you to notice that they are foolish, lying, pompous, or whatever. So that's a top tip for reading narrative. And if you notice that, all sorts of things emerge. So characterization, plot, speech. One thing to notice is repetition. We tend to yawn when we see repetitions in the Hebrew Bible. Oh, for goodness sake, we read that a minute ago. Actually, repetition is there for a reason. When you find repetition, pay attention to how it compares with the first version of it. Because it is in the differences that striking things emerge. I'll give you an example, if I may. Do you know the story of Naboth's vineyard? So Ahaz is king of Israel, and he looks out of his palace window and he wants his neighbor's vineyard, Naboth, okay. And he goes to Naboth, and he's entirely reasonable, and he says, please may I buy your vineyard for good money, or I'll give you a better one out of town, you know, up to you. So he doesn't go, he's not trying to steal it, he goes, he's entirely reasonable. And Naboth says this. Naboth says, the Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. It's a three-part thing, okay? The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. The reason he says that is because this is his patrimonial land, and he is forbidden from disposing of his patrimonial land. It is against the law. You have to retain land within the family to protect your children's inheritance and to honor your fathers. So that's what he says. Now, Ahab's really sulky about that, and we could talk a lot about how he's characterized in that text, but we haven't got time. But anyway, Ahab's really sulky, And he drops off home. And as he goes home, we get the second iteration of what Naboth said. And it's kind of in Ahab's head, or as he's muttering it, we hear it. And what we get is, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. What's dropped out? The Lord forbid. Okay. And he gets home, and if you remember, he takes to his bed, and he turns his face to the wall. And his wife comes in and says, oh, what's up? And he says, Naboth says he wouldn't sell me his vineyard. No, Naboth didn't say he wouldn't sell you his vineyard. Naboth said, the Lord forbid that he should give you the inheritance of his fathers. And so as we notice that Ahab is descending from civility and that he is manipulating his account of events to his wife in order to evoke her sympathy. And there's lots of other things like that going on in that particular text. But that's an example. So notice repetitions and notice where they're different and what they are. That's communicating perhaps about who's speaking or what's going on. Are you with me so far? And then I think this is my last tip before we move on to something more specific. I think it is no coincidence that the name of the nation in the Hebrew Bible, the name of the people of God, is Israel. Now, you might have expected it from the story to be Abraham. He was the first one, wasn't he? You might have expected it to be Jacob, because he was the one who had the 12 sons. But it's called Israel, which, of course, is the name that Jacob was then given by God. Israel means he wrestles with God. Wrestler. It is no coincidence, I think, that that is the name that this nation takes. And I think that wrestling characterizes their conduct with God, both in positive and negative terms, but not wholly negative. And I think that wrestling makes its way into the Hebrew Bible itself. And we get, as I'm going to show you actually an example in a little while, we get places where it sounds like there's more than one voice kind of having a bit of an argument about what's going on. We need to notice that wrestling, and we need to understand that we are invited to wrestle too. One of the wonderful things about the book of Job, I think, is it is an invitation to wrestle with God with the unanswerable questions of our time, of our world. And Job is commended. Job is commended, and yet he has wrestled. He has asked God some very hard questions. He has challenged God very boldly, and yet at the end he is commended. Read the Psalms, as I'm sure you do, and you'll notice the wrestling that is there. And so I think as we approach these things, and as we read stories that challenge us, that make us feel uncomfortable, it is fine to wrestle with them. But we need to be aware that, as with Jacob when he wrestled with God, he came away limping. And if we're going to do this, we need to be prepared that we're wrestling with a bigger opponent than us, and that we may be altered by the experience. Actually, a sort of illustration of the altering is given here. The technical term for this is the hermeneutical spiral, but you don't really need to worry about that unless you're particularly interested in these things. This is the idea that wrestling will change us. And the illustration I like to have is I get on the train, and I'm going to read, I don't know, let's say the book of Exodus. And I get on the train as Helen. I used to be a doctor. I'm now a Baptist minister. I've got two teenage daughters and one who's past her teens, and all of that. I am who I am, and I begin that journey as Helen. And I read the book of Exodus. And hopefully, I read it prayerfully, and I read it attentively, and I read it with a willingness to hear God speak to me through it. And let's say I travel to, I don't know, Newcastle. It's given me a long time to read it. And I get off that train, and I'm not quite the same Helen that got on. If I've done my job, if I've been reading faithfully, and the Spirit has been at work, I'm not quite the same. I'm kind of Helen Mark 2, okay? Now, when I come to go home, let's imagine that I then say, well, I'm going to read the book of Exodus again. So I get on as Helen Mark 2, which is not quite where I was before. Hopefully, I understand things a little better. Hopefully, I see the world perhaps slightly more the way God sees it. And so as I then approach that same text and grapple with it again, hopefully I read it a little bit better. I understand it a bit more deeply. And so when I get off for the train back in Bristol, I'm Helen Mark 3, because I have been changed a little more. This is this idea of wrestling and how it will change us. Does that make sense? So I invite you to wrestle. Let me try and give you a kind of idea of how I approach Old Testament violence. I am going to shamelessly plug my book, and I have none to sell because I'm completely out, but you can get it on Amazon. I wrote this book, and really what I'm talking about today is some of the ideas that I've put down more fully here. And I wrote this book because I was phoned up one day, years ago, by our church youth worker, saying one of the young people in the church is reading some of these texts of violence in the Old Testament, and I think she's going to lose her faith. And have you got any suggestions, Helen? And Helen had no suggestions at all. But the question didn't go away. And so many, many years later, I wrote this book notionally for that teenager and for people in the churches who are grappling with it. So it is aimed at people who are, you need to be prepared to think hard, but I don't think it's particularly difficult. And it's certainly, you don't need to have any theological training for it. Now, the reason you've got a picture of an onion there, you may be wondering, it's not to do with us crying. It's to do with the fact that one of the most common things I hear when people talk to me or ask me questions about Old Testament violence is I hear the language of kind of all of that violence in the Old Testament, as if it was a kind of simple lump, as if all the violence that we encounter in the Hebrew Bible is kind of doing the same thing and presents the same problem. And that is not just among people who haven't done theological training as well. There's a very, influential book that has been published in recent years, which makes exactly that mistake. I mean, it just lumps all the violence together as if it could all be solved with the same answer. And I think that is really foolish, actually, and I think it's very short-sighted. So there is lots of different types of violence in the Hebrew Bible, and they need to be addressed differently. It goes back to the simple question of genre that we were talking about earlier, really. And they present different levels of difficulty to us, I think. And so this is why I've got this idea of an onion rings, like. Because what I do, I try and kind of peel them away and say, well, let's look at the outside one, the easiest one. I think the easiest one is described violence. And described violence is violence that we encounter because the Hebrew text is giving us an account of what life was like in those days. And life back then, as indeed today, was inherently violent. And so it tells us about that violence. I'm going to refer briefly to a text that is a trigger text for some people, so I'll just warn you of that. I'm going to refer to the story in Judges 19, which some of you may be familiar with, and actually I find that many people in the churches aren't familiar with, and it is a very, very difficult, painful text. So Judges 19 describes the gang rape, murder, and dismemberment of a woman called, referred to in the text as the Levite's wife. And I've just written a book on this subject, actually, this chapter. Now, this text is often criticized for being a misogynistic text, and it proves that this is a misogynistic book, that it has this account here. And I think that is a wholly unhelpful way of looking at that story. The book of Judges is characterized by a phrase that comes back a number of times. And some of you probably know what it is. And the phrase is this. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And often when I'm quoting scripture, I will make language gender neutral. But I tend not to with that instance, because the book of Judges is an account of what happens when there is inadequate leadership, when there is a power vacuum. And what happens when there is a power vacuum, and we have seen it in our news stories over, in this decade and in previous decades, what happens when there is a power vacuum is the powerful abuse the weak. And very often, of course not exclusively, but very often that falls over gender lines. And that's what's going on in the book of Judges, among other things. And so that's what we read in Judges 19. We read this appalling story of violence, of torture and violence and sexual violence against this poor woman. The book of Judges is a charge sheet against ancient Israel. It is an account of its crimes. And I think we would be indignant, and rightly so, if we did not read of violence against women on that charge sheet. I think we would say to one another, it surely went on. Why did it not matter enough to the ancient writer that it gets included? And so the inclusion of these stories tells us something that something about the concern of the ancient writer for even that woman, who's not just a woman, which immediately puts her in an underclass, but she is an underclass woman. She's probably a concubine or a second wife. Either way, she's really pretty much the lowest of the low. And yet that story of what happens to her and the events that directly result from it, that is the climax, if that's the right word to use. I struggle to find the right word to use there, but that is the climax of the book of Judges in terms of the indictment against the nation. And I think that tells us something about God's concern for that woman and others like her who suffered. And I think actually we need to recover some of these stories and we need to use them. We need to speak of them. We need to dare to use them in our congregations, carefully, sensitively, by those who know and love the congregation and know the stories of those within the congregation. But I think that recovering those stories can give voice and dignity to those who still have suppressed and have been forced to keep silent their own stories of abuse. So we have described violence, which I think we should read about. It should be there, if you see what I mean. Because it happened, it should be within our text. It shouldn't be airbrushed out. So I think that is probably, and obviously there's a lot more I could say, but just broadly speaking, I think that's probably the easiest of the types of violence that we encounter in the Hebrew Bible. So we kind of peel that skin of the onion away, and then we read the next one. And the next one, I think, is implored violence. It's violence where someone, usually a psalmist or sometimes a prophet, is praying to God and saying, in the sort of thing that David referred to earlier, you know, Lord, oh, that evil would fall upon my enemies, and sometimes much more specific evil is requested. Not the sort of thing that we tend to use on a Sunday morning, not the sort of thing that we tend to sing in our worship songs. Sort of thing that makes us very uncomfortable. And I think there's a number of things we can say about that, and I don't want to linger too long because I'm going to set myself the challenge of talking about the hardest, the inner core of the onion in a moment. But a couple of things we can say. One is that we need to allow people space to express how they feel about things that have happened. Something about the value of catharsis. Something about the value of being able to speak to God as a kind of as a safe place to park those feelings of vengeance and then leave them with Him. It's actually very hard. If you have prayed to God to take vengeance on your enemies, it's actually much harder than to go away and do it yourself. There's a sort of duplicity there. There are things that we say to God in the privacy of our homes, the privacy of our hearts, that we don't want others to know, or we don't want to become real, but we need to say them anyway. I won't linger. Oh, no, there's one more thing to say about that. And that is that the language the psalmists use when in these particular passages is the language of the enemies of God, largely, which are often the enemies of the psalmist. But if we read on into our New Testaments, the language of the enemies of God is reframed in the New Testament. The enemies of God and the enemies of humankind are not people. It's made very plain. Apostle Paul says, our enemies are not flesh and blood, but the principalities and powers. And the last enemy to be destroyed, Paul also says, is death itself. Now, if we were to list the enemies of the people of God and the enemies of God, I think we would list things like child abuse and genocide and coronavirus and cancer and so on and so on and death. And against those, depersonalized enemies, I'm up for praying, smite your enemies, Lord. I'm up for praying that, because actually we are saying, come, Lord Jesus. And so I think there is a place to recover these, actually, as long as we use them carefully and wisely and with explanation. I think there's a way for us to recover these for our congregations, because together we are praying for peace. We're praying for God's good kingdom to come. Divine judgment, I'm going to say probably even less about. But the next layer of the onion then is where we encounter violence as a direct consequence of God's intervention in judgment. It's getting trickier. We'd much rather not see fire burning out from the ark and consuming people, I think. We'd much rather not see the earth destroyed in a flood. What I would say is that, well, let me just tell you a story which I refer to in here. Has anyone read a book called The Locust Effect by Gary Haugen? Okay, well, that's your homework. Go and read The Locust Effect by Gary Haugen. It's not a theological book. It's Gary Haugen founded the International Justice Mission, IJM, which I hope some of you have heard of. IJM works to help authorities, legal authorities, to bring about justice, to make justice happen on the ground. They're particularly interested in finding and freeing people who have been victims of human trafficking and bonded labour. He tells a story, Gary Haugen, in that book, about a woman called Mariama who was enslaved in a brick factory in a country in the Indian subcontinent. And the man who owned the brick factory and his son not only enslaved Mariama and many others like her, not only forced her to work, I don't know, 16 hours a day or something hideous, but also repeatedly raped her. Now, IJM found Mariama and managed to get her out. And then they began the process of trying to bring this man and his son to justice. And they make, off the top of my head, about 23 visits to the courthouse to try and make that happen. And every time they are thwarted. The police can't go and take a statement because someone's stolen the wheels from their car. Every time they are utterly thwarted in their ability to bring justice to this man. And they end the story by saying, yes, we got Mariama and others like her out, but that man knows he is free to go and do it all over again. The reason Haugen calls his book The Locust Effect is because he says that just as if you have a farm and you irrigate it and you put the choicest of crops in and you do everything and you look after it really well, and none of it matters if the locusts come. None of it matters. And he says, it doesn't matter what else we do, if we can put in schools and healthcare and infrastructure and education, I've said that already, but if people do not have access to a judicial system that works for them, it's like the locusts can come and nothing else matters. And this is his particular passion. It's a very powerful book, changed the way I saw quite a lot of the world, actually. But it illustrates really well, I think, why judgment is good news, because we need a God who cares about justice and who makes it happen. And I said this the other day, and I could see the shocked faces in the room, so I'm going to phrase this carefully, or at least let me, I'll qualify after I've said it, but I say in terms of judgment, it's good news and bring it on. Now, what I don't mean is I want to see people burn in hell. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is I want to see an end to those enemies of God that we were talking about earlier. I want to see an end to sickness and death. I want to see an end to abuse of the weak. I want to see an end to sexual violence. I want to see an end to child abuse. I want to see an end to all of these things. And it is through the judgment of God that that will come about. And it can't come soon enough as far as I'm concerned. So judgment is good news. And I think we need to hold that as we grapple with some of these texts, which admittedly present us with some problems and some questions. There's more I could say, but I want to move on to the hardest, because I think I might be able to shed a few pieces of light on that, but I won't be able to solve it altogether. Is that okay? You still with me? Right, good. So the hardest, the kernel, do you have a kernel of an onion? The inner part is the hardest part of all, I think, is where the text appears to say to us, and God said, go and do this act of violence. And I do not have a fully sealed, wrapped up answer to this question, and I'm really sorry. I continue to make it my life's work to try and find it, but I haven't found it yet. But there are some things we can say, and let me try and show you some of them. The first one is to talk about a particular word that crops up in our Bibles and is sometimes rather unhelpfully translated. Now, no one's trying to be unhelpful. The issue is that in no two languages does one word exactly map to another. And so this word cherem has quite a wide range of meanings, and it's very hard to collapse that down into a single English word or even a single English phrase. But sometimes I think we misunderstand this as, so you'll read the language of you shall utterly destroy or you shall utterly slaughter, that sort of language. That's this word being translated. But it's more subtle than that. Let me try and give you a kind of indication of that. Something that is designated for cherem, some of those things are people, and some of those things are things. Okay, so that immediately tells us that it doesn't equal kill, because you can't kill a thing. Okay. Sometimes objects that are designated cherem are brought into the sanctuary. Sometimes objects that are designated cherem are taken outside the camp where people defecate. Sometimes objects that are designated cherem are described as most holy to the Lord. Sometimes objects that are designated cherem are described as abominable. You can see, I hope, this is a complex word. Now, what does something that is most holy have in common with something that is abominable? And the clue is actually where they go. Sorry? Untouchable. Quite so. Untouchable. So the root idea of cherem is separation, is setting it apart from normal use. Whatever normal use means. It is devoted to God, but that doesn't necessarily mean it is brought into the sanctuary, as I've indicated. Sometimes it means it is discarded, but it is removed from circulation, if you like. So if you had a £5 note and I said that was cherem, we'd have to take it out of circulation. Yeah, we'd have to destroy it or burn it or something. That is the root idea of cherem. Now, I wish I could tell you that it never means kill, and it clearly wouldn't be true. It clearly does sometimes mean to kill. But that is not the core idea. The core idea is removing it from circulation, is removing it from normal life. So one of the ideas of cherem, behind cherem, is encapsulated in a little command that says, you shall not marry your daughters to their sons, and you shall not marry your sons to their daughters, okay? Because you're not to behave with them as in the normal way. In the normal human way, you're supposed to separate them in some way. Now, sometimes that does mean killing, and I wish I could tell you it didn't. Sometimes it does, but not always. Hold that thought, and I'm going to try and build on that. The next question, in fact, let me just see if I can find a little table in the book, because that might help us. The next question is, what did people really die in huge numbers? I think if you go into your average church, and you can tell me whether you're an average church in this regard or not, and ask people, what does the book of Joshua say? I suspect that most people would say, well, it tells us that Joshua scorched into the land and killed everything in his path. Yeah. And I'd like to suggest that actually, Joshua itself, the book itself, is much more subtle than that. And we often miss it. I'm not quite sure why. We sort of read it with our preconditioned lenses, I think. So, let me read you some examples. This is Joshua 10, verse 20. The first half of the verse says this. When Joshua and the Israelites had finished inflicting a very great slaughter on them until they were wiped out, the second half of the same verse says, and when the survivors had entered into the fortified towns, hang on, I thought they were wiped out. That's the same verse. I'll give you some other examples which are a little further apart. Joshua took the city of Debir and committed to Harem every person in it. That, the next chapter, Joshua came and wiped out the Anakim from Debir. Well, hang on, I thought he'd already killed everyone there. I'll give you one more example. Joshua 11, in fact, it's picking up. Joshua came and wiped out the Anakim. He utterly destroyed them with their towns. None of the Anakim was left in the land of the Israelites. Four chapters later, Caleb drove out from Hebron the three sons of Anak and the descendants of Anak. Well, hang on, I thought they'd all been destroyed by Joshua. It's like we've got two voices in the text. Now, this is a painter theory. I cannot swear to you that this is how it is, but this is what I think is going on. I think that what we have going on here is, and I'm not necessarily saying this is written by two different writers, but that we have this sense of two different voices kind of in dialogue with one another, almost in an argument with one another. And I think one is kind of making the theological claim of the land is ours, we took the lot. And the other one is saying, yeah, and actually it was a bit like a Swiss cheese, and they took that bit but not that bit. But the land is ours, and we took, so there's a kind of theological claim going on. Okay, and then there's a kind of slightly more dispassionate kind of account of actually what it looked like on the ground. We get something similar when we read an account of the borders of the promised land. In some parts of the Hebrew Bible, the borders are described as absolutely astronomical. They begin over in Mesopotamia and they end over in Egypt or somewhere. They're absolutely enormous. Never, ever did Israel own anything like all of that. So sometimes you get those borders being described, and other times you get, you know, the little tiny patch of land that Israel actually took possession of described. Sometimes you get the language that Joshua took the whole land and owned the whole land, and then you get the language of, oh, but he didn't take that bit and all that bit, and those people were unconquered, and these people continued to cause trouble, like a Swiss cheese. It's like we've got this theological claim and this other voice in dialogue with it saying, actually, this is what it really looked like. That's just what kind of what I think is going on here. So that's one of the things to say in answer to this question. The next thing to say, and I've not taken them in order because I don't know why, because I'm not, is that we need to understand that the accounts of ancient battles are always told in a particular way. Actually, they're told, if we read it carefully, they're told in a very stylized way, which in itself it invites us to realize that there's something kind of rhetorical going on here. You know, if you read a newspaper article that kind of spoke with a particular flourish, you would think, well, I don't know, I think this is kind of, you know, it's giving me a particular slant on things here. So we've got rhetoric going on here. This is not to say, this shouldn't reduce our confidence in this book as the Word of God, because the Word of God contains many types of writing, and there's no reason on earth why it can't, in fact, it most certainly does contain rhetorical writing, writing that is intended to influence its readers. So we get rhetoric, we also get, I think, hyperbole, and I think that is well understood in the age that everybody, when they tell their battle accounts, inflates the numbers. It's just the way they talk. If you read some of the other ancient Near Eastern accounts of battle victories, they talk about how, you know, I piled up the dead and I smote them and they're millions, and, you know, we read these stories and it sounds quite similar in Joshua. That's the second thing to say. The third thing is to say this. If you were a father and a husband living in, let's say, AI, okay, and you've got your wife and your children there, and you watch Jericho going up in smoke, what are you going to do? They're not interested in the peoples of the land. They're interested in the cities. The cities have strategic value, okay? So AI has strategic value. It needs to be taken. So if you are the head of a household, you will, I think, send your dependents away. You'll send them out into the countryside where you hope they'll be safe, and you may stay to defend the city yourself. That's human behavior. People don't keep, if they can possibly can avoid it, they don't keep their families in the path of an advancing army. It's just simple common sense. We actually read that, a story like that, in the book of Samuel, where Saul is going to a particular city, and he's got a particular agenda against a certain group of people within that city, and he sends word ahead and says, I'm coming. you other lot can clear out. And, well, they do. So we do know that this sort of thing happened. And just normal human behaviour would suggest that cities were probably manned by men, by soldiers, and not by women, children, and so on. How am I doing, golly? Right, the final thing to say on this slide is that archaeology is quite an ideologically driven enterprise. We tend to think sometimes that archaeology is an objective science, and it isn't. And pots and things need interpreting just as much as texts do. But interestingly, those archaeologists who really are set out to prove that the Bible is really historically accurate in every part, who are called maximalists, and archaeologists who set out to prove that the Bible has no contact with history at all, called minimalists, they largely don't agree on much at all, but they do broadly agree on the question of the conquest, and they both say the conquest was reasonably gradual. It happened over maybe a generation or two. Doesn't appear to have happened in the course of, you know, a couple of years. Interesting that archaeologists on both ends of the spectrum seem to think that. And that would then seem to go with what we are already reading in the text, that this is not quite as kind of, as aggressive as we might sometimes think. I'm just wondering what I should do in the remaining time that I have. Because you want some time for questions, don't you? Let me just see. Okay. So what is going on here? Let me just say a couple of words about what did they think they were doing? This is one of the key questions, is what did they think they were doing, and what did the writers think was happening theologically at the conquest of Canaan? I mentioned very briefly earlier the other ancient Near Eastern creation myths. If you were an ancient Near Eastern deity and you went to ancient Near Eastern deity school, then the first thing you would learn is how to create. And what an ancient Near Eastern god does when he creates is he clears chaos. I mentioned this earlier. There's primordial chaos, and he clears it back. And in the clearing of chaos, he separates order out of the chaos, and then he shapes it, and he names it, and he gives it a function. The other way that you can express that is that he has to kill the chaos monster. And all of these ancient civilizations had their chaos monsters. You've got one there that we can see. There's lots of others you can find if you Google it, the chaos monsters, often called Lotan, which is related to the word Leviathan, which we encounter in the Hebrew Bible. So we even read of this mythology of chaos monsters in the Hebrew Bible as well. Now, there are lots of indicators in the book of Joshua that what they are doing in theological terms is something rather like this creational activity. That you've got these peoples who are kind of filling the land, if you like, and they are other, they are viewed as, the language of abominable, actually, which is used, is probably not the language of sin, because these people have never been given a covenant and a law, and so the idea of sin doesn't really apply to those people. But they are kind of other, and they are kind of this. In this ancient mind, they are kind of this undifferentiated other that needs kind of clearing aside, as chaos always does, in order that land might be cleared. Think the creation account in Genesis 1. Think the flood, land being cleared, the water being pushed back. Think the Red Sea, land being cleared with water being pushed back. This is a recurring theme. And here we have it again, with land being cleared in order that something, and that a new world might be established here. This is a mythical way of thinking. It's not the way we think at all, but I think it's what they view what they are doing. I think the language of punishment of the Canaanites is quite unhelpful. I've heard this sort of language. Well, they were so sinful that they needed to be kind of cut out. You know, in order that they didn't kind of infect the Israelites. That is very disturbing language indeed, I would like to suggest, because that could be lifted from Adolf Hitler's playbook. So I think that understanding that the language of sin is not generally being used of these people, and that describing them as receiving judgment for sin is probably not the most helpful way of viewing what is going on there. There is subtlety, there is complexity there, but as a kind of headline. So let me just quickly point out some countercurrents in the book of Joshua, and I've actually shown you some of these already. So I've talked about how complete the destruction was and the fact that we have kind of one narrative and then like a counter-narrative almost coming in the other direction. I've spoken about the boundaries of the land as well. Let me go to the bottom, the fourth one there. You may well remember this story, and it comes early on in the book, when just on the eve of the Battle of Jericho, when Joshua, commander of the army, is walking out his worries the day before the battle, as I guess commanders of armies always do. And he meets a man with a drawn sword. Remember this story? Now, we are going to discover that this is an angel. Okay, but he doesn't know it's an angel. He just sees a man with a drawn sword. And he asks the age-old question that you always ask if you see a man with a drawn sword when you're on a military campaign. Are you friend or foe? Now, just think about this for a minute. If Joshua had known that that was an angel, I don't think he would have dreamt of asking that question. Joshua was in Egypt. He saw God act in the plagues. He was there. He experienced the Passover. He came out. He was led by the fire and the pillar. He was led through the desert. Mustn't forget the Red Sea. Saw the Red Sea part, saw Pharaoh consumed behind him, engulfed behind him, led through the desert, sustained in the desert, taken to the mountain which quaked with the presence of God. God makes a covenant with this people alone. Has Joshua ever had a moment's cause to doubt that God is 100% on their side? I think not. And I don't think he'd have asked that question if he'd known he was speaking to an angel, but he doesn't know. He thinks he's speaking to a man, and so he says, friend or foe? And then we get the question, the answer that I'm sure you all know, which is neither. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Now, admittedly, that angel then goes on to give him instructions about how the battle is to be conducted. And they go on to win the Battle of Jericho, but they lose the Battle of Ai, which follows. And I think that moment, when God shows up and says, I'm not on your side, Joshua, don't misunderstand this, I'm not on your side. This needs to condition our reading of the whole of the rest of this book. And I think sometimes we miss the significance of that moment. It's a very significant moment. The language of in and out, sometimes we think that the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, had kind of very tightly controlled boundaries in terms of ethnicity. And we imagine that this kind of the killing of the inhabitants of the land is to avoid diluting that ethnicity. This is sort of troubling sort of language, isn't it, in our day and age? But I think we need to notice the countercurrents to that. And you will be familiar with the story of Rahab, I'm sure. Rahab's story is perhaps even more extraordinary than you might have noticed. Rahab, in case anyone is reminding, is she was a prostitute in Jericho. She was a Jerichoite, not an Israelite. The spies come, she hides the spies, and she makes a confession of faith. She makes a confession of faith which is comparable to a confession of faith that is made by only two other characters in the Bible, Moses and Solomon. They're the only two other people who make a confession of faith like Rahab's. She makes a confession of faith, and in return for that, she is saved from the destruction of the city. But what is the thing that saves her? Go on, you know this story. What's the thing that saves her? Sorry? The red cord. Okay, now that hangs in her window. Now imagine you are the army coming, okay, and you walk around the city, and then the walls fall down. What is your natural ingress into her residence? Because her window is in the walls of the city. That is your route into her house, okay? That red cord is what stops you from going in to kill her. Does that remind you of anything? A story that happens a few chapters earlier? I think here we meet a Passover for a pagan family. or actually a family that's rapidly not becoming pagan, family that's rapidly finding faith in the God of Israel. Now, that is a stunning moment, I think, and we should notice that. And then the next chapter, we get Achan, who does the opposite, who is within the community of God, but doesn't live out the faith, the obedience that faith demands, and so is put out. The other story, a bit like Rahab's, which I really love, and I think is much less well known, is the Gibeonites. And if you've ever heard the Gibeonites preached, I bet my bottom dollar I know how it was preached. The Gibeonites were a people. They were also called the Hivites, and they are one of the seven nations that were designated for Harem. Okay, and they trick Joshua. They pretend they've travelled a very long way, and they come with mouldy bread and cracked wineskins. Do you remember? And they arrive and they say, oh, we've travelled such a long way, we've heard your fame, and we don't want you to destroy us. We live ever such a long way away, we won't be in trouble to you. Could you make a covenant with us? And Joshua doesn't consult God, and he makes a covenant with them of peace, which he's then bound to keep, even when he discovers that they actually just up down the road. Now, if you've ever heard it preached, I bet my bottom dollar that the preacher said, oh, Joshua didn't consult the Lord. Now, that's not the point of this story. That's not the point of this story. The point of this story is these people seized by faith the promise. They chiseled their way into the covenant by faith. And that is deeply admirable, as indeed Rahab does, as indeed Ruth does, if only we had time to talk about Ruth. These are people who see that God is doing something and are determined by hook or by crook to be in on that. And the Gibeonites are a wonderful example of that, and a real counter-narrative to what we might understand as this narrative of perhaps ethnic purity, or this narrative of this kind of massacring of the other. Right. David asked me also to speak briefly, phew, got to my penultimate slide, about what we might do with these. I know that we are asked these questions by people who don't share our faith commitment to the text. And it is really hard. It is really hard to answer them. Richard Dawkins is a case in point, who has made really quite aggressive and vitriolic comments. I've actually written a fairly detailed response to that particular chapter in Dawkins' book, and it's on the blog of the Centre for the Study of Bible and Violence. So if you're interested, you can see what I've written there. These would be my top tips. Do you know, I'm done with lying to non-Christians. I can't be doing with it. I cannot be doing with pretending things are not how they are. And I think too often in churches, this is a general comment, and it's not necessarily a comment even for our own time, but for the decades that have passed, too often we have felt we need to put on this kind of squeaky clean, whiter than white facade and pretend that everything's well in the church, pretend we're completely sorted in our lives, pretend we have no doubts, and pretend the Bible doesn't present any difficulties to us. And I think it is fundamentally dishonest, and I'm not having any of it. And so I commend that, and I think this is the Christ-like way to be. I think something about honesty and vulnerability is Christ-like. And being prepared to say, I don't know, I believe, model something or reflect something of what Jesus modeled. I'm not saying Jesus went about saying, I don't know, but I think our modeling, our imitation of him might look like that. I recommend that you try to deconstruct that, all that violence in the Old Testament language. Try and take the sort of approach that I've talked through a little bit tonight. I think that, yes, unpacking it and looking at the different ways it functions, some of the problems disappear, or at least look different and easier if we do that. I think point to cultural change, point to the way the world is very, very different now from the way it was. Point to the fact that this people is still learning what God is like, and we're still learning what God is like into the New Testament. Point to the way genre works. Point to the way that not all texts are doing the same thing and are serving the same purpose. But don't get bogged down in that. Point to Jesus. Point to Jesus, because no one's going to be saved through a really good answer to to the genocide in Joshua. There are, I do believe, that if we can help address problems that are stumbling blocks for people, then they may be more likely to come to saving faith in Jesus Christ. But it is saving faith in Jesus Christ that is the goal. And so the book I've written mainly for people in the churches, but my hope is, and I think I say this somewhere in it, is that for those who aren't yet believers, but want to kind of, are willing to ask the questions, are willing to engage in the kind of thought experiment of, if this was the word of God, how could we address these questions? Then, you know, I'm hoping that this might be of use. It's not going to persuade someone, it's not going to persuade Richard Dawkins. But I don't think anyone's going to persuade Richard Dawkins. Point to Jesus. Have your conversations around Jesus if you possibly can, because he is, he's the center of it all. And be like Jesus. I've already said that. But let's always be like Jesus. There's no point in winning the battle and losing the war. I'm not sure if that's very helpful in that image, but you kind of know what I'm saying, I think. I'm sorry, I never really managed to leave very much time for questions. If you have, if you want to read more, some suggestions, and I've plugged my book enough. This book by Paul Copan and Matthew Flanagan, Did God Really Command Genocide? It's a tough read. He writes like a lawyer, actually. It's a very careful, philosophical read. Philosophical? No, more like a forensic analysis, really, like a lawyer. Anyone here read it? I don't actually wholly agree with him, but he's an excellent scholar, and he certainly, many people find his arguments plausible. So I would commend that one to you. I would commend the John Walton book, The Forgotten World of the Israelite Conquest. Walton's written a number of books now called The Forgotten World, which I realise sounds a bit like a dinosaur set of movies, but it isn't. And he looks at how understanding the culture of the ancient Near East helps us to understand Genesis texts and the conquest and so on. I do commend all of those books, actually. With regard to this particular set of questions, The Forgotten World of the Israelite Conquest is very good, I think. Easier to read than the Copan book. If you're interested in the sexual violence of the Hebrew Bible, the very well-known book, Phyllis Trible, Text to Terror, would be worth reading, although I don't wholly agree with her either. I've published on it recently, but it's an academic monograph, so you need to be prepared to do quite hard work. We've got stuff on our blog, actually, quite a lot of stuff about about Judges 19 and so on. I've put one in brackets here, which is the book by Greg Boyd called Cross Vision, which is his slim version of a really big, meaty book. I put it there because a lot of people seem to find it helpful. I think he's wrong. I don't commend it to you, actually, but I would be dishonest not to say that that is there, and some people do find his approach useful. It is called Crucifixion of the Warrior God. But it really is, you need to kind of... Actually, if you're going to self-isolate for about 4 months, then you might just about get through it. I would suggest, if you want to read Greg Boyd, I would start with Cross Vision, because I think he encapsulates his ideas very well there. He needed an editor with a red pen to cut down the other one, in my opinion. It was a bit too long. And as I said, please do feel free to go on our website and have a look there. There's talks and all sorts of things. And get in touch with me, and I'm very happy always to try and help in any way I can. I don't have all the answers, but we serve a good God, and God is always good. Thank you.
Let's thank Helen Cherie for that.